Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and on Thursday the 15th of June, these are our main stories. A damning report finds the former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson deliberately lied to Parliament. People in North Korea risk their lives to tell the BBC about widespread starvation. More than 170,000 people are evacuated as a cyclone nears India and Pakistan. Also in this podcast...
Don't be funny with my money, honey.
How Beyoncé caused inflation to rise in Sweden. An eagerly anticipated report by British MPs has found that the former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, deliberately lied to Parliament over gatherings at his official residence during coronavirus lockdowns. It's a dramatic fall for a man who only a year ago was leading Britain after having successfully engineered Brexit and won a landslide victory. A campaign group which represents families bereaved by COVID said that the report had shown how Mr. Johnson had, quote, broken his own rules so he could have a party and a laugh as families were saying goodbye to loved ones over Zoom. Last week, Mr. Johnson resigned as an MP, calling the committee investigating him a kangaroo court. It has now hit back, saying he has impugned its work and undermined the democratic process. So, a damning and unprecedented report in the way it's admonished a former Prime Minister over his conduct. Our political correspondent is Rob Watson.
It is indeed. In some 1,000 years of British parliamentary history, I don't think that any former Prime Minister or Prime Minister or senior minister has been on the receiving end of such an utterly damning report, because although it's quite long, it's a 30,000 words, like a sort of small novel or something. I mean, essentially, it's quite simple. It just says he has lied to Parliament, and then he has compounded that by undermining Parliament's authority, by undermining the institution with these allegations of kangaroo court. I mean, it is impossible, Jeanette, to imagine anything more damning.
And what's the reaction been to this from Boris Johnson himself and from his critics?
So Boris Johnson has continued the line of approach that he took last Friday, which is to go on the attack against the committee in two ways. Number one, a sort of personal attack on them, saying that they've got it in for him personally and that there are some on there who are Remainers as opposed to Brexiteers. But it's also to undermine it by saying, look, the whole thing, as he says, has to be lies and rubbish, because how could he have lied to Parliament when he didn't believe that he was doing anything wrong? So that's the sort of basis of his defence. Now, of course, critics of Boris Johnson are saying this has just proven what we've known all along, that he was never fit for high office, that he has a kind of problem with the truth, and that he should have never have been there in the first place. And it was fascinating listening to one of our sister programmes on domestic radio, people calling in response to the report, and the vast majority were immensely hostile to Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, the impact on voters and trust in politicians and the wider impact on the governing Conservative Party.
Well, to take the latter first, I mean, it seems to me the big question now in British politics is there going to be a civil war now in the Conservative Party between those who still like Mr. Johnson and who think he's been really hard done by, and between them and the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, and his followers? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, clearly some of Mr. Johnson's supporters are very unhappy indeed. As to how this all goes down with the British electorate, I mean, Mr. Sunak's hope is that somehow they will move on, that Mr. Johnson will be forgotten, and he'll be seen as a sort of a new brush. But of course, the danger is for Mr. Sunak and the Conservatives is that the voters will look at this and say, my goodness, what is going on? What is this party? What have the Conservatives been up to? They're divided. They've had a Prime Minister who should never have been in office. What is going on?
Rob Watson, it's the world's most secretive country. It's also hell on earth, according to North Koreans the BBC has been communicating with in secret. They speak of widespread starvation, brutal crackdowns, and no chance of escape. This as the government continues to spend vast amounts on its nuclear program. The North Korean leader Kim Jong-un slammed shut the border 3 years ago to stop COVID getting in, causing great hardship. But three people living in North Korea have risked their lives to tell the BBC what is really happening there. Our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie, has been secretly exchanging messages with them for months with the help of an organisation in South Korea called Daily NK. One of the three is a construction worker who we're calling Chan Ho. His words have been voiced by an actor.
Often we have to work late into the night and I sleep at the site. I wouldn't be able to survive if my wife didn't work at the market. When they closed the border, everything became scarce. The price of grain, sugar and seasoning has shot up. Food supplies are so low, people have started dying. At first, I was afraid of dying from COVID, but then I began to worry about starving to death. It's been so long since we received government rations. We somehow survive on what little food there is. But it's hard not knowing how much longer we will live in this pinched poverty. The future is dark. Food supplies are so low, people have started dying. In our village, five people have starved to death. In one family, their wife was too ill to work, so two children were surviving by begging. In the end, all three of them died. The official cause they were given was death from disease. In another household, the mother was sentenced to hard labour for violating quarantine rules. She and her son starved to death. Recently, an acquaintance's son was released from the military because he was malnourished. Suddenly his face became bloated. He died within a week. If you're suspected of having COVID, you and your entire household will be locked down and not allowed to take a single step outside. During one lockdown, I know of five people that were trapped in their house for 10 days. They were half dead by the time they were let out. They managed by sneaking out at night to get food. The people who stayed at home could not survive. Every day it gets harder to live. One wrong move and you're facing execution. If I live according to the rules, I feel like I'll starve to death. But just by trying to survive, I could be arrested by the state security, branded as a traitor, and killed. This is the hardest period I've lived through. The famine was difficult, but the state completely lost control. So there weren't these harsh crackdowns and punishments. If people wanted to escape to China, the government couldn't do much. Now, there are fences and surveillance equipment. People are stuck here and waiting to die.
A North Korean we're calling Chan Ho, who's been communicating with our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie. She told us that COVID had given the North Korean leader the opportunity to further repress his people.
I think this border closure did start because of the pandemic. You know, Kim Jong-un was terrified that COVID would wipe out, you know, huge swathes of his population, many of whom are malnourished. But the longer that this has gone on, and clearly every country around the world has now reopened apart from North Korea, I think it's become clear that he has used this to sort of really tighten his grip over his people, as you say. And the levels of repression that we are hearing from these people inside the country seem to be almost the kind of highest they've ever been. People are talking about, you know, now not feeling that they can put one foot out of step. And the fear that this is spreading in society seems to be really great. We've heard, for example, about new laws the government have brought in this time. So now if you share content that's come from outside the country, so that could be foreign films or TV programs, particularly content that's come from South Korea, you can now be executed. And not only are these laws and punishments increasing, but the kind of crackdowns that enforce them are increasing. So people have told us that there are now groups that go around neighbourhoods, as they say, ruthlessly cracking down on people. And so this is all sort of controlling the population much more than before.
And how does this compare to the last time we heard about widespread starvation in North Korea back in the 1990s? The situation was very different then technologically. It was much harder for people in North Korea to find out about the outside world.
So during the famine, you know, which was probably the bleakest time in North Korean history, right? You know, you had as many as 3 million people, we think, died. But the difference was during this time that people could escape if they wanted to. And actually, because the government understood that the economy had collapsed and it could no longer provide people with food and rations as it used to, it gave them these small fragments of freedom to be able to do what they needed in order to survive. So escaping was one of those things, but they could smuggle things in from the country. They could operate their own private sales. This informal economy of North Korea sort of grew up. But what's happened with this period is people are very struggling to find food. We know that people are starving, albeit not on the same level by any means. But the government, by controlling people during this difficult time, is almost stripping them of those little means that they'd had in order to be able to survive. So it's kind of cutting these lifelines one by one. And I think that's what makes this period now so unique and so concerning for people.
We put our findings to the government of North Korea, or Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK. A representative from its embassy in London said, "The information you have collected is not entirely factual, as it's derived from fabricated testimonies from anti-DPRK forces. The DPRK has always prioritised the interests of the people, even at difficult times, and has an unwavering commitment to their well-being." And if you want to watch Jean McKenzie's documentary on this, it's called North Korea, The Insiders. As we record this podcast, a powerful cyclone is bearing down on India and Pakistan. Strong winds, heavy rains and rough seas are already hitting the coastline of the Indian state of Gujarat. In Pakistan's southern state of Sindh, the authorities are warning of storm surges that could reach as high as 4 metres. Across both countries, more than 170,000 people have been evacuated. Aircraft have been grounded and fishing boats ordered to stay in port. Let's hear from both Pakistan and India. First, our reporter Arunade Mukherjee, who's in a village near the port city of Mandvi in Gujarat.
The wind speeds have really gone up considerably. It's been raining in bursts. So when it rains very hard for a few minutes and then it stops. But the intensity is fairly strong. The landfall is expected later this evening. We're inching closer to that time and it is reflecting in the way in which the weather has really been changing. If you speak to the people, they say that we've seen these kind of scenarios play out repeatedly in the past. But this time around, despite the fact that there is resilience and a sense of resignation in their voices, they're also aware that it is different because the wind speeds, a lot of locals told me, is very different this time around. I've been in touch with a lot of the authorities and they've said they've evacuated about 67,000 people so far. A lot of the key concern areas is where a lot of the relief teams are pre-positioned, hoping that basically the priority for them will be to ensure that essential services are minimally hit.
That's the picture in India. So what's the situation in Pakistan? Our reporter Saha Baloch told us how they're preparing in Karachi.
The government has established around 75 relief camps across the province. So they have said that they have evacuated around at least more than 60,000 people and they want to evacuate more. I also got to know that some people stayed back in their cities or in their districts because they are afraid of their things being taken away or they're afraid of theft, basically. So this is something that we saw during the floods as well. So right now the situation is developing over here because a lot of people are refusing to leave their homes in Karachi, for instance. It is one of the biggest cities of the Sindh province. And over here around the coastline, especially the seaside area, that has been completely evacuated. But there are still certain people who refuse to leave.
Saha Baloch in Pakistan, and before her we heard from Arunade Mukherjee in India. Survivors from a boat that sank off southern Greece in one of Europe's worst migrant disasters say up to 100 children may have been on board. Nearly 80 people have been confirmed dead so far, but hundreds more are thought to still be missing. The Greek government has declared 3 days of national mourning. The Coast Guard had said it had tried to help rescue people on the boat hours before the sinking, but that's now being disputed by some of the survivors who've been taken to southern Greece. Nick Beek reports from there.
Although 106 people were brought to safety, some of them have been talking to the authorities and they estimate that up to 700 people could have been on board this fishing boat that sank. So that raises the possibility of an horrific death toll, potentially 500 or even 600 people having lost their lives. There's confusion over just how many people have died, but also there's confusion over the exact timeline. And the Greek Coast Guard have claimed that they went to help people on the boat, but actually that offer of support was refused, However, a group which looks after migrants who are in difficulty on the waters, they said that actually the Greek authorities knew for hours that this was in peril. This is reflected in some of the newspapers this morning. You've got a government-supporting paper talking about the anatomy of a tragedy, giving weight to the official version of events that the Greek Coast Guard presented. But if you look at the left-wing publications in Greece today, they're talking about a premeditated crime. In other words, the authorities knowing what's happening and not helping the migrants in sufficient time. And shame is the headline on one prominent left-wing newspaper this morning. So there is a search and rescue mission that we hope to see later today. But, I mean, hope has pretty much evaporated in terms of finding anyone else who may have survived. Because, remember, this was 50 miles out to sea in the deepest part of the Mediterranean. So for those on board, when the ship went down in the early hours, it would have been pitch black. You can only imagine just how horrific that would have been.
Nick Beek. Still to come.
We were able to identify many of the key ingredients that we associate with life. The type of life we're probably talking about are microbes, single-celled organisms.
We hear how a moon orbiting the planet Saturn may have the ability to support life.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service that goes beyond the spin, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news. An honest explanation of the events shaping our lives. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. One of the pioneers of advanced artificial intelligence has said it's ridiculous to say that it poses a risk to humanity. Professor Yann LeCun is a chief AI scientist for Meta, the owner of Facebook. He's been speaking to reporters at the company's offices in Paris. Our senior technology reporter, Chris Balance, was there.
In 2018, three researchers won the Turing Award for work on neural networks that underpins modern artificial intelligence. Two of these so-called godfathers of AI have warned about the risks the technology might pose to humanity in the future. But on a swelteringly hot day in Paris, Professor LeCun told an invited gathering of tech journalists fears that a powerful AI might be developed and suddenly take over the world were preposterous. Human-level artificial intelligence was years, maybe even decades away, he said, and AI wouldn't cause huge unemployment, though it would change work. Jobs in 20 years' time might be as unimaginable as being a YouTube star would have been a generation ago.
Chris Balance. Our solar system's second largest planet, Saturn, is 1.4 billion kilometres away and has almost 150 moons. Now, a new discovery suggests that one of its biggest moons may have the capability to support life. Data from Cassini, a space research mission by NASA and the European Space Agency ESA, has revealed that a liquid ocean on the moon Enceladus is the first outside Earth to contain phosphorus, the so-called missing ingredient to sustain life. Dr. Chris Glein is a planetary scientist at Arizona State University, one of the study's co-authors. He told my colleague James Copnell why finding phosphorus was so important.
It matters because phosphorus is known as one of the big six elements in biology. There's carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, and phosphorus. And phosphorus is usually the rarest one. So it's often thought to be a limiting element for life on Earth. And it's important for Enceladus because people like myself and other scientists are interested if Enceladus might have the right stuff for life.
And are you fairly confident then that there are the conditions for life there now of some form?
Yes, we're fairly confident. We had a phenomenal mission partnership between the U.S. and ESA. It was called Cassini-Huygens. And through the course of that mission over a decade, we were able to identify many of the key ingredients that we associate with life.
When you talk about supporting life, what exactly do we mean? I mean, perhaps we don't know exactly, but it's not necessarily human life or animal life, plant life. I mean, what are we talking about here?
So the type of life we're probably talking about are microbes, single-celled organisms, and we're basing our understanding on life on Earth. We only know of one biochemistry, and that's life on Earth. And so we're using the requirements that we know life on Earth needs, and those are liquid water, a source of energy, and the key building blocks. And previously, we found evidence for a global ocean of liquid water on Enceladus. We found the key energy sources that would be provided through hydrothermal processes on Enceladus. And phosphorus is one of the few missing ingredients that we just recently found.
And how do you actually go about finding phosphorus?
This was not expected before the mission, but the Cassini mission discovered that Enceladus is erupting a huge plume into space from its south pole. And it turns out, based on the chemistry of that plume, we learned that the plume is actually sourced from the liquid water ocean in the interior. So what we can do is we were able to fly the spacecraft through the plume, and we were also able to fly the spacecraft through what's known as the E-ring of Saturn. This is it's like a ghostly ring that is fed by the plume. And so by analyzing the chemistry of those materials, we could get new information about the ocean conditions on Enceladus.
So what's then the obvious next step?
Well, the next step, there's a few things. We're going to continue to mine the data. The Cassini mission ended in 2017, and now this paper is being reported today. But eventually, if we want to answer the life question, we're going to have to send a new spacecraft mission back to Enceladus with the goal of searching for evidence of life. Cassini just did not have the kinds of advanced instrumentation that we would need to look for what are known as biosignatures. These are molecules like different kinds of amino acids, for example, the building blocks of proteins that we could look for either in the plume or we could land on the surface near where the plume is erupting, and we could sample those frozen ocean water samples to look for any of these evidence of life.
Dr. Chris Glynne. The secretive British street artist Banksy has announced his first official solo exhibition for 14 years. The show will open at the Gallery of Modern Art in the Scottish city of Glasgow on Sunday and will run for 3 months. The exhibition will feature work from throughout Banksy's career, including pieces previously only seen in the occupied West Bank. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson went to the preview.
Called Cut and Run, 25 Years Card Labour, this is pretty close to a full Banksy career retrospective. He has used his original stencils to create new versions of many of his best-known works, including Kissing Coppers, which first appeared in Brighton, and Mobile Lovers, featuring a hugging couple who are both looking at their own phones over the other's shoulder. The show aims to reveal how his works are made, with a detailed model explaining how he managed to shred his Balloon Girl painting during an auction at Sotheby's. As for why the exhibition is being held at Glasgow's Gallery of Modern Art, Banksy says it's because his favourite piece of UK art is right outside. For the last 40 years, despite the efforts of the council and the police, members of the public have been placing a road cone on the head of a statue of the Duke of Wellington.
Colin Patterson. Now, not only is Beyoncé a global superstar, it seems she has the power to raise the cost of living. Swedish inflation fell below 10% in May, but it was still higher than expected. And that's partly the fault of the singer and her adoring fans. Rebecca Wood reports.
Get your money, 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 money. Don't be funny with my money, honey.
Don't be funny with my money, sings Beyoncé. But maybe she has got a bit funny with Sweden's money. The country reported higher than expected inflation in May, and there are suggestions the global superstar could be behind it. Her world tour in Sweden last month sparked such a frenzy of demand for hotels and restaurant meals that it's shown up in the country's economic statistics. Michael Grahn is Danske Bank's chief economist in Sweden.
What caught our attention a couple of weeks back was that we heard stories that all the fans coming here to Sweden were having problems finding hotels in Stockholm. Actually, they had to move further and further out in the suburbs. They bid up prices on hotels. So that is essentially the impact it had on inflation. It bid up hotel rates.
There is little doubt that the singer's first solo tour in 7 years marks a big economic moment. At least one estimate suggests it could gross more than $2 billion by the time it ends in September. Searches for accommodation in cities on the tour shot up after it was announced, and tickets for many concerts sold out within days. We'll have to see if future hosts also get what Visit Stockholm described as the Beyoncé effect. But back to Sweden, where analysts predict the situation will return to normal this month. Although they might not be able to rest easy just yet, a quick search for concert tickets online, and it looks like Bruce Springsteen's heading their way in the next few weeks. Pay me.
Oh dear, that report by Rebecca Wood. The Oscar-winning actress and former politician Glenda Jackson has died at the age of 87. She won 2 Academy Awards for Best Actress during her career, but declined to go to Hollywood to receive the Oscars, saying she was more interested in acting than in accolades. In one of her most noted television roles, she played Elizabeth I in a BBC drama.
I have no love for Rome, as well you know. But we must exercise great care and circumspection. Religious observance is a personal matter. Spiritual needs vary from person to person. I have no wish to open windows into men's souls.
After an illustrious career, she then turned from acting to politics, becoming a Member of Parliament in North London. She famously used a speech in the House of Commons to attack the former Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher.
We were told that everything I had been taught to regard as a vice, and I still regard them as vices, under Thatcherism was in fact a virtue. Greed, selfishness, no care for the weaker.
Our arts reporter Vincent Dowd told us she was an all-time great.
Born into a blue-collar family, 1936 in Birkenhead near Liverpool in the north of England. Father a bricklayer, left school, went to work as a sales girl in a shop. Started acting in a very small way in an amateur group, and then everything changed. In about 1954, got a scholarship to RADA in London, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. To win that only a couple of years after starting amateur productions was absolutely amazing. Went into repertory theatre, had small parts in TV. Not elegant in the way that an earlier stage actress might have been, but came to be seen as having a real force in her performances. 60 years ago at the Royal Shakespeare Company under Peter Hall, took her on and she became a big name in the play Marat Sard. The big films, well, we can't list them all, but Women in Love in 1970, for which she got her first Oscar of 2. Sunday Bloody Sunday, 1971, directed by John Schlesinger. In its time, very daring about its openness in sexuality. A Touch of Class, 1973, the Hollywood film for which she took her second Oscar. And she was also a big star on TV, especially in the BBC's Elizabeth R.
And she refused to go and pick up those Oscars, and she later moved into politics.
Yeah, she gave it up. It seemed forever, stood as a Labour MP in the 92 general election of the UK, which was basically for Labour a bit of a disaster, but she did very well. She had a reputation for being bluntness with Labour in power. She eventually became a junior minister. Very briefly, I was editing a TV programme about London politics at the time. I always found her approachable and very easy to deal with. I think her reputation for bluntness was very overstated. She had an extraordinary career, even going back on stage, indeed to play King Lear after she left politics. An absolutely extraordinary career. And one film, I think, still to come out, a film with Sir Michael Caine called The Great Escaper. That will be her farewell to her audience around the world.
Vincent Dowd, looking back on the life and career of the actress Glenda Jackson, who has died at the age of 87. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Dan Ehrlich. The producer was Lipika Pelham. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Do
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service making sense of the big stories.
People go to jail here for insulting the president. People are afraid to express their views on social media. They're certainly terrified to go to a demonstration.
We look beyond the headlines, exploring the important questions about long-running stories and the latest global news.
Why is the volatile Wagner Group boss screaming insults at the leaders of Russia's armed forces?
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.